This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The town of Goma is under threat to be taken by rebels, full control of that, so that they can continue to loot Congo's resources for the benefit of the world corporation and mostly U.S. interests. Do Americans know that the Rwandan military is funded by U.S. taxpayers' money?
Kambale Musavuli of the Center for Research on the Congo tells us how people in the U.S. can hold Elon Musk, Tesla, and their coltan provider Glencore accountable for the millions murdered since 1996 in the wars for Congolese minerals.
Panama belongs to the Panamanians. The canal belongs to the Panamanians. The sovereignty of the canal belongs to the Panamanian people, and the Americans have nothing here.
We hear from Panamanian labor leader Saul Mendez Rodriguez about the history of Panama and President Trump's threats to invade the country to take back the canal.
More money for Ukraine, more money for Israel, more money for Taiwan. You know, they were very unpopular at a time when North Carolina had towns washed away, fires, you name it, and the Biden administration continued what they were doing. And I think if the Democratic Party wasn't in bad enough shape, they kind of finished it off.
Pacifica broadcaster and independent podcaster Garland Nixon talks about the early days of Trump 2.0 and the Democratic Party implosion. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The European Union is reportedly under pressure to revoke a memorandum of understanding about importing resources from Rwanda because of Rwanda's war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Here's my report. In 2024, Congolese decried the mineral sourcing agreement that the European Union signed with Rwanda because minerals are obviously smuggled across Rwanda's border with the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Decades of UN Group of Experts reports on DRC have confirmed this. During the Second Congo War, Rwanda created a Congo desk to organize the illegal exploitation of Congo's natural resources. In 2018, the experts reported that Rwanda had that year officially declared gold exports of 2,163 kilograms, while the United Arab Emirates officially declared gold imports of 12,539 kilograms from Rwanda. The experts' December 2024 report included satellite pictures of the border crossing points from Kibumba, DRC to Rwanda used for minerals trafficking. Speaking to PBS, Congolese Foreign Minister Therese Kayikwamba Wagner pointed to the Rwandan minerals trafficking at the heart of the conflict.
The Rwandan Defense Forces have been occupying very strategic areas in eastern DRC. I want to speak about Rubaya. Rubaya is mine in all of the region. According to United Nations experts, Rwandan Defense Forces have used forced labor to force children, women, and men to mine artisanal mines to get coltan. And in a month, the Rwandan Defense Forces exploit and transfer over 150 metric tons of coltan that are then shipped over to Rwanda and exported to global markets under the label of Rwandan minerals. So we see that this is an endeavor that is economically driven and that has no compunction whatsoever to violate human rights, to displace thousands, if not millions of civilians, and also, again, to kill peacekeepers that have been sent by the United Nations to bring peace and not to be killed.
That was Congolese Foreign Minister Therese Kayikwamba Wagner. Next, Block Report Radio's J.R. Valray sat down with Kambale Musavuli of the Center for Research on the Congo to talk about the impact of Trump's announcement that he will invest $500 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money into artificial intelligence. Within hours of Trump's announcement, Rwanda's M23 militia and Rwandan defense forces invaded the city of Goma, the capital of Congo's North Kivu province, looking to secure minerals for U.S. tech giants. They also discussed how people in the U.S. can hold Elon Musk, Tesla, and their coltan provider Glencore accountable for millions of deaths in wars for Congolese minerals since 1996.
Can you talk a little bit about what went on right after Trump announced that he will be investing $500 billion into AI? How did that announcement affect the Congo?
You cannot talk about AI infrastructure without talking about the Congo, because the AI models are going to run on computers, sophisticated machines. And all these machines are connected directly to mineral resources in the Congo, such as coltan, cobalt, and lithium. But since the announcement, there have been movements in the DRC, movement going in the wrong way, where militia groups are tied to Rwanda, including Rwandan soldiers, have crossed over into the Congo. They've displaced millions. And as we speak right now, they are threatening to take control of Goma. But there have been many areas in the Congo for the past 2 years that actually took control over. The town of Bunangana for over 2 years has been under rebel control. And these rebels somehow find their way to the mines in DRC. Right, so the M23 rebels have been controlling one of the largest, I would actually say the largest mine of coltan in the world, in the town called Rubaya, and they've been exploiting it, shipping it to Rwanda, and it finds its way in modern-day technology. So we hear the excitement, right, of people talking about ChatGPT. We hear the discussion around DeepSeek, the new AI model. But we know people are talking about the fourth industrial revolution. But these things cannot happen unless you control Congo's mineral wealth. And in the prospect of controlling Congo's mineral wealth, millions have died since 1996. And as we speak today, the town of Goma is under threat to be taken by rebels, full control of that, so that they can continue to loot Congo's resources for the benefit of the world corporation and mostly U.S. interests.
We've been getting information in the news that South Africa and Malawi, among other nations, are helping to defend Congo interests against the Rwanda M23 militia. Can you give us some more information?
South Africa and Malawi are part of a military contingent of the SADC community. SADC is a regional community like ECOWAS. It's the Southern African Development Community, and this includes countries in Africa below the equator, mostly below the equator, right? Congo is a member of that community. Since Congo has been facing this rebel militia and the inadequacy of the Congolese military, the Congo requested support from SADC members to join into the fight to free the Congo. So South Africa sent their troops. Malawi sent their troops. Tanzania also have sent their troops. While the South African contingent is one of the biggest contingent of African soldiers in the Congo. But as the rebels pressed on taking more and more town and through fight, fortunately, in the past 2 weeks, South Africa has lost 14 soldiers. As of today, the number is now at 14, because one passed today as he succumbed to his injuries. But these soldiers, right, we have to look at it very clearly in the context in which they die. Right? They are there part of the SADC mission, but they are also there as part of the UN mission. The UN has a military mission of peacekeepers in the DRC, the largest in the world. Their annual budget is $1.2 billion a year. So the UN Security Council sent them also there to help the Congo, right? Now, they have been killed by Rwandan-backed soldiers and Rwandan soldiers, as documented by many sources now. We know Rwandan soldiers are there, and we know also that M23 is there. The question now becomes, when Rwanda and the proxy that they support is killing another African brother, what will we do to hold them accountable? Because killing a peacekeeper is a war crime. And that's the discussion that's been ongoing for the past 2 days about how we can hold one another accountable, right? Like during the apartheid regime, when there was apartheid, African nations held the apartheid regime accountable. Rwanda is doing the bidding of the West in Central Africa by getting access to resources and killing South Africans and killing also Congolese. Will we, as an African community globally, right, in the diaspora and on the continent, hold Rwanda accountable for the crimes and educate people about what is happening? Because it's so essential that we stop the killing in the Congo. If we do not stop the killing in the Congo, it's actually affecting the development of Africa. Malcolm X knew it. Lumumba knew it. Kwame Nkrumah knew it, right? The essential part Congo plays in the development of Africa. And Congo has not been free since 1885. In 2025, we are calling on ordinary people, wherever they are, to be at the side of the Congolese as they try to liberate the country and hold those who are committing the crimes accountable from the continent all the way to Washington, D.C.
Recently, there was a documentary released on the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Congo, called Soundtrack of a Coup d'Etat. In the documentary, they talked about the role that the UN played in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. Recently, the United Nations has been discovered in Congo actually stealing minerals themselves. Can you talk about the UN's relationship with the Congo in specific and how they basically have been in peacekeeper roles, but they've also played the role with the oppressors?
The UN's Security Council is one of the most problematic councils that exists. The UN Security Council, as it relates to the Congo, has played a very devastating role because of a few nations in there, specifically the United States and the United Kingdom. They have taken positions that affect the Congo. So anytime there have been actions to hold perpetrators of violence in the Congo accountable, they haven't done anything. Let's use the example of the UN Security Council meeting that took place on Sunday, January 26. Evidence presented to the UN Security Council, it was chaired by Algeria, pretty much most of those who spoke clearly said that the M23 rebels are supported by Rwanda and that Rwanda should stop supporting these rebel groups committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in the DRC. Yet, at the Security Council, no action has been taken. The only action I can't even mention that they have taken is the call on a meeting, and they listen, and they move forward. So that's one role. The lack of accountability for crimes in the Congo when they have the power to stop it is one devastating role. The second one is holding perpetrators of violence accountable. Member states of the UN, right, specifically even UN Security Council members, have the responsibility to hold perpetrators of violence accountable. They allow them to open bank accounts in their countries. They allow them to trade freely. They allow them to actually move Congo's minerals into the countries without any accountability, right? So the last one is the question of justice. The United Nations on October 1st, 2010, published a report called the UN Mapping Exercise Report, calling what's happening in the Congo war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possible genocide if proven in the competent court, singling out Rwanda for committing genocide in the Congo. This was published in 2010. We are in 2025, so it's almost 15 years later. How come after this report, there is still no tribunal to hold the perpetrator of violence in Congo to justice when the Congolese people are waiting for justice? So there is a culture of impunity that exists where when crimes take place, the UN watches. It happened in 1960. It's still happening today.
Recently, there was a lawsuit accusing Apple of working with child slavery in procuring the minerals from the Congo. That lawsuit failed, but the DRC as a nation has issued another lawsuit to Apple, and I believe it includes other big tech corporations. Can you talk a little bit about what this lawsuit is detailing and, you know, what are we hoping for in this case?
So the case for Apple, I believe they've taken it to European courts, if I'm not mistaken. It's actually being held in Brussels, in Belgium, at the moment. While it may sound like a good action to hold electronic companies accountable, but it's important to understand the supply chain, right? Holding Apple accountable will not stop today. The rebels in the Congo were taking over the city of Goma, the M23 backed by Rwanda, right? That action will not do that. Even if Apple is found guilty and they have to pay, that will not fundamentally change Rwanda's and Uganda's negative actions in the eastern part of Congo, where they continue to support rebel groups. Why am I saying that, right? It's because Apple is about 4 to 5 steps down the supply chain. Apple is not a mining company. But we know the mining companies, right? So the mining companies to hold accountable are very well known. But I will mention who we should hold accountable. We should hold Elon Musk accountable. We should hold Elon Musk accountable because willingly, his company, Tesla, gets the cobalt that they use for the batteries of their electric cars from a mining company called Glencore, a Swiss mining company, right? Traded even in the New York Stock Exchange. But Glencore has been found guilty in a case brought by the U.S. Justice Department. And the U.S. Justice Department brought a case against Glencore. Why? Because of the dealings that they did to get access to their mines in Congo, which was violating U.S. law around corruption. They bribe African politicians to get access to it. And they settled with the Justice Department, paying fines to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. The case is online. People can Google Glencore Justice Department and you see the case. And you see what it did in Congo. And you will see also the fine. But how did Glencore get this mine? They got this mine through an Israeli businessman named Darren Gertler, who sold them this mine, who got this deal of the mine through illegal processes too, according to the U.S. Treasury Department. The U.S. Treasury Department has sanctioned this Israeli businessman for his dealings in Congo. And with his deal with Glencore, for every sale of cobalt that Glencore does, he gets 3%, which is equivalent to $250,000 a day. So every day, then you have to get $250,000 a day. And Glencore has found ways to be able to get him the money, even though he's under sanction, right? I'm very clear with the Trump administration coming that if I want to make an impact, I should go after Glencore when it comes to mining and cobalt and so on. If I want to make an impact in stopping the M23, I'll get the U.S. government to stop using U.S. taxpayers' money to fund the Rwandan military. Do Americans know that the Rwandan military is funded by U.S. taxpayers' money?
Probably not. Most don't.
That's where we should go. People are reading in the news that Trump has stopped aid to Africa and to the world. Has he stopped military aid? No. Is AFRICOM still running across Africa? Yes. AFRICOM is the U.S. military branch for the African continent. So if that was a serious action, that's what we should ask. All U.S. military bases out of Africa. All U.S. military support to oppressive regime out of Africa. How will that make an impact? The rebels in the Congo are using night vision goggles. They have anti-drone missiles. They are scrambling GPS signal of airplanes and helicopters. Do you buy these things at Walmart?
Right.
Of course not. These are military support from the U.S. U.S. citizens, through the taxes that they pay, are funding directly a genocide in the Congo. So if you want to stop the exploitation of Congolese, get your government to stop funding oppressive regime on the African continent. Go after Tesla for taking cobalt coming from the Congo, giving the Israeli businessman Dan Gertler $250,000 a day. Why? Because he's vested in two construction companies out of Canada that's building a wall in Palestine. A cement company, a construction company in Palestine. So he takes the money he makes out of the Congo and go oppress the people in Palestine. But there is still a silence on the genocide in the Congo. That's what people can do. So the case of the Congolese government is a distraction. So it's a competence to bring peace and stability in the Congo, but also a distraction to hold the real actors behind the exploitation of the Congo, the U.S. government and some of the mining companies that it supports.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. I want to thank you for updating us on what's going on in the Congo. That was the voice of Kambali Musavuli of the Center for Research on the Congo. Where can people go to get more information?
Always go to friendsofthecongo.org on social media as well. You look for Friends of the Congo. They are keeping people up to date on the situation in the Congo and support their work. You can follow me also on all social media platforms, Kambali. You look for me, you'll see every single day I'm posting on the situation in the Congo and what is happening to the people on the ground who are fighting for change.
You were just listening to the voice of Kambali Musavuli of the Center for Research on the Congo. Many people are protesting American singer John Legend for being set to perform in Kigali, Rwanda on February 21st. We are asking our listeners to let John Legend know that Rwanda is initiating a genocide in the Congo with over 18 million people dead and millions displaced. Let him know that he is a collaborator to this genocide if he performs.
That was Kambali Musavuli of the Center for Research on the Congo speaking to J.R. Valre. For more from JR, visit blogreportradioworld.com.
No woman, no cry. No woman, no cry. I remember when we used to sit in a government yard in Trenchtown. Overall by serving the hypocrites, mingle with the good people we meet. Good friends we have and good friends we've lost along the way. In this great future, you can't forget your past. So dry your teeth, I say.
And that was the Nigerian artist Tems, who recently canceled a concert in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, to protest Rwanda's war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. President Trump's threat to invade Panama is not the first, and the U.S. did in fact invade Panama in 1989. Saul Mendez Rodriguez is the president of Soontrax, the largest union in Panama, which represents construction workers. He spoke to KPFK and Workweek Radio's Peter Ross and Julian, an international student. Both are members of UAW 4811.
Thank you for talking to us, Saul, about your union and about the history of American imperialism in your country.
I am Saul Mendez Rodriguez. I am the General Secretary of the National Union of Workers in the construction industry and similar Soontrax of Panama. We are affiliated with the National Confederation of Independent Trade, Union Unity, CONUKI. We are part of the Construction and Wood International at the international level with an international union that brings together 13 million members. I am the global deputy president of this structure, representing Soontrax and our region in the global south. And Soontrax is one of the most important organizations, historically speaking, for workers in Panama, one of the largest organizations in quantitative and qualitative terms. And naturally, in addition to our labor demands, we have had to face more than 30 hard years of neoliberal economic policy of the so-called Washington Consensus. We have been victims of neoliberal economic policies in the midst of this confrontation. We have been victims of the assassination of leaders, imprisonment, persecution, stigmatization by the class enemy, its political parties, its mass propaganda media. But we have faced all of that, and we continue to contribute our grain of sand in the social struggle, in the workers' struggle, and in the Panamanian popular struggle, in the face of the different issues that we have been facing. We have been part of that current of the Panamanian people that has demanded the defense of its sovereignty, its self-determination, its canal, the withdrawal of Yankee troops from Panama, and the handing over of the reverted areas. And we are heirs to that great group of social fighters in Panama who have faced the U.S. interventions throughout the 20th century. Panama was born as a republic under the interventions of the North Americans because of their interest in building the canal that had belonged to the French. In addition, this conspiracy hatched in Panama by the U.S. government and its army preceded the Thousand Days War, which was related to a war that was taking place in Colombia. Panama was a part of this war. After it joined Simon Bolivar's project in 1821, it became independent from the Spanish crown, and it was one of the last countries to break away from what was known as Gran Colombia at that time. And the gringos supported this act that took place in Panama immediately through Bruno Varilla. He was appointed by the Provisional Governing Board. He was given the status of full ambassador, and the Buenos Varilla Treaty was agreed upon, which granted the construction of the Panama Canal, its adjacent areas, 10 miles next to the canal, and the U.S. military presence in perpetuity. This naturally was rejected by the population from the moment it was agreed upon. And this brought with it a series of incidents due to this oligarchic betrayal against the sovereign will of the Panamanian people. In 1904, the first constitution was legislated in Panama, and in it was included Article 136, the Platt Amendment, or the Platt Clause, that had been applied to Cuba in the gringo intervention in the War of Liberation of Cuba in 1898. And it was applied in 1901. And what does the Platt Amendment say? What it indicated was the impunity of the U.S. to intervene militarily in the internal affairs of Cuba. Well, that was transferred to the Panamanian Constitution with the same basic meaning. The U.S. Army and its government not only counted the votes in Panama, they organized the elections. They even decided to repress the people if there were problems of a socially explosive character. And during those first three decades, I'm referring to 1903 until the 1930s, it was the American army that used force to repress the Panamanian people. In incidents that occurred, such as, for example, the tenants' struggle that took place in Panama against the increase in rents that the oligarchy wanted, the Panamanian presidents asked for the intervention of the Americans, especially in Panama City and Colón. All of this was happening in one episode after another. The Canal Zone was an enclave where there was American jurisdiction, American judges, American police, American laws, the American army, and all kinds of incidents occurred. From young boys going to harvest a mango, and they were put in prison, to the abuses that occurred based on the arbitrary actions of the Americans in a territory that did not belong to them. This had the consequence, for example, that in 1947, an attempt was made to impose a new treaty in Panama at the time when the Second World War had already ended, and they were planning to leave 100 military outposts throughout the country, which was the outcome of the Filos-Hinds Agreement. And the people were in the streets, faced with this pretension of the traitorous oligarchy and the American government. This was defeated in the National Assembly with ongoing mobilizations. The agreement had to be withdrawn. In the 50s, there was an operation that was known as Operation Sovereignty. A group of students in 1958 and 1959 planted Panamanian flags on what were the slopes of Ancon Hill, which was a part of the national territory taken by the Americans. At that time, there was repression. The peak of the patriotic struggle of the Panamanian people became known to the world in the events of January 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th of the year, 1964. There, the students of the National Institute went to place a flag at the Balboa High School, which was a Sonian school, because that area was known as the Sonian Zone. And there, despite the fact that there was an agreement that where there was a gringo flag in the national territory, a Panamanian flag also had to fly, it was not fulfilled. There was an attack against the flag, against the students, and this brought about a confrontation between the humble, honest, and hardworking Panamanian people with stones and sticks against the American army. There were 21 victims of this patriotic act. The people demanded that the Americans leave the country. And this then was a source of instability for the Americans and their army here. In the year 1967, in an event that was held in Havana, that was known as part of a wave of Latin American solidarity organizations, the leader, Floyd Britton, revealed a treaty that was being negotiated behind the backs of the Panamanian people between the oligarchy and the Americans. The treaty would allow the maintenance of military bases. There, at the conference, this secret treaty was translated. It was denounced in that international act, and the people mobilized. The treaty could not be approved. And in 1968, a year later, there was a military coup d'etat, like the coups that took place all over Latin America. The guerrillas, the military, who murdered and persecuted people, Panama was no exception, made people disappear. And in 1968, the military favored discussing a treaty with the Americans again. That is how we arrive at the 1977 treaty. While it is true that the 1977 treaty returned control of the canal and the reverted areas and led to the withdrawal of American troops, it is equally true that the Hay-Bunau-Varilla Treaty and the 1903 treaty remained in effect, along with the Pratt Amendment and the so-called De Concini Amendment, which was tied to the Neutrality Pact. And what this amendment says and repeats is that, in the opinion of the Americans, when they believe or feel like saying that the canal is at risk, they can invade the entire territory of Panama. We have denounced this to the present, and future generations must repeal it. This is against international law. No nation is subordinate to another, nor can it be intervened against by another, according to international law. However, the statements made by Trump, and now Marco Rubio, who was named foreign minister, they call him the American Secretary of State, that they have claims in Panama in relation to the canal, in relation to their presence, that they are going to recover it, this is not debatable. The message of the Panamanian popular movement has been very clear. Here, neither the Americans nor Trump and his army nor any American institution has anything in Panama. Panama is a sovereign country. It has a people that exercises its self-determination. These people, they exercise their self-determination according to the rule of international law, exercise the sovereignty of a state, both in their territory and in the airspace and maritime waters. And so Trump is showing, in our opinion, an imperial delirium in the face of a changing world. The world is changing geopolitically, and his response is to try to talk about the Panama Canal, Greenland, Canada, Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, in a total aberration that I must point out is an aberration based on manifest destiny, which is the ideology with which the US imperialists took over and invaded lands in America. They took a piece from Mexico, etc., the Monroe Doctrine, etc. The last wars, the Bush Doctrine, the seizure of the oil wells in Iraq, in Libya. In short, then, they are trying by force to create a different reality. The reality that we are invoking is that the canal is Panamanian. And neither Trump, nor Marco Rubio, nor the US government, nor the State Department, nor its army, nor Congress, because we have also seen that a Democratic congressman has presented a bill to buy the Panama Canal. There is nothing for sale here. Panama belongs to the Panamanians. The canal belongs to the Panamanians. The sovereignty of the canal belongs to the Panamanian people, and the Americans have nothing here. That is the reality. And, naturally, in the face of that, protests have been held. From the first moment Trump made his statements, protests have been held. And we are ready for January 20th, when the Trump government takes office. We are ready to see what will happen on the one hand, and on the other hand, we have organized a picket action at the house of the American ambassador in Panama with the organizations of the popular movement for Trump's inauguration. That is how things are in Panama right now, and that is how they have developed in relation to this issue.
That was Panamanian labor leader Saul Mendez Rodriguez speaking with KPFK and Workweek's Peter Ross and Julian, an international student. was Ruben Blades, Patria Panama. Next, Capitalism, Race, and Democracy producer Thomas O'Rourke spoke to Pacifica broadcaster and independent podcaster Garland Nixon about the early days of Trump 2.0 and the Democratic Party implosion. This is part one of their conversation.
Garland Nixon, good morning, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to come on your show, Thomas.
And our pleasure as well. So, what are your general thoughts on the beginning of this new Trump administration, and do you discern any significant differences between his first term, the beginnings of, if we can go that far back, and the beginning of his second?
Yes, definitely differences. One of the big differences is in Donald Trump's first term, he seemed to not really know what he was doing when he came in. He seemed to feel his way around. He seemed extremely inexperienced in the workings of politics in Washington, D.C. This time, Donald Trump seems to be quite experienced. He seems to have put together a very different kind of cabinet, which is interesting. And he seems to have an idea exactly what he wants to do, and he's very assertive in doing it. Now, that's notwithstanding, there's some things I totally disagree with, some things I do agree with, but a better knowledge of how DC works and an assertive, pre-prepared agenda. Those are the two things that I would see as different. The main two things I would see as different.
Okay. What are your thoughts on the election itself, on the campaign the Democrats ran, and why Trump and the Republicans ran the table by taking the White House, the House, and the Senate?
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, that was my prediction. I predicted that the Republicans would blow it, that it would be a blowout, and I predicted that they would win all three. It was there were a number of reasons. The first, of course, being economics. The people were hurting. Working class people were hurting due to inflation. And the Democrats made a fatal mistake by, instead of acknowledging that, they said, no, 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 all you have to do is go to our website right here where we have charts and graphs that will show you that things really are good. So I think the people were angry. They felt gaslit on top of the fact that the policy direction of the Biden administration was very neocon. It was very pro-war, and the neocons tend to completely disregard domestic policy. I saw they totally disregarded domestic policy. And I think this was blowback for a very, very poorly run 4 years, and for the subsequent inflation from heavy overseas spending and various things. So the bottom line is this, I'll put it like this. They lost because of the way they governed. Yeah. I mean, if I said the way they govern, they can't possibly accept that. I understand that. But that's a reality.
On that note, what do you think of the exit of the Biden's ignominious cabal? Those are my words when I refer to Blinken, Sullivan, Garland at DOJ and Jack Smith. And what of those preemptive pardons? Any chance that those could be challenged legally, given that they are for crimes yet exposed or even admitted to?
A couple of things. Number one, what I thought was interesting was the period of time that, shall we call it an interregnum, you know, when old things are dying and new things are being born. After the election, after it was obvious that the Biden administration had lost and they had a couple months left, traditionally, what presidents will do is kind of, you know, prepare the ground for the next president and get the heck out the door, right? The Biden administration doubled down on things. They then doubled down on their war. They tried to set up the circumstances where that Donald Trump wouldn't be able to undo their foreign policy. Their focus for that last couple of months was still on war. It was on foreign policy, how to keep the wars going, how to keep the money for wars going. And they, I think, basically finished blowing up their party. If their party wasn't in bad enough shape when it got wiped out on November 5th, they finished it by doubling down on unpopular foreign policies. More money for Ukraine, more money for Israel. And those things were unpopular. More money for Taiwan. You know, they were very unpopular at a time when North Carolina had towns washed away, fires, you name it. And the Biden administration continued what they were doing. And I think if the Democratic Party wasn't in bad enough shape, they kind of finished it off.
Yeah. One other thing I did not mention
the pardons. The thing I think is the truth is no presidential administration will back off or turn the volume down on pardons because that's something they all want. They won't go after any pardons because they all want to have that power when they leave. The one thing you can say is this. They have really empowered the Trump administration. Whenever he leaves office, he can pardon the hell out of anybody, and they can't say a word because they set up the dynamic now where you can pardon anybody, family members. He can pardon everybody he knows for the last 50 years. It doesn't matter now. They've created a new dynamic. Traditionally, we didn't see these preemptive pardons backdated for 10 years. Well, guess what? You're going to see it, start seeing them now. So that was a bad legal precedent that was set by the Biden administration.
Did Trump pardon family members preemptively or anything, did he?
No, and I don't recall any of these preemptive pardons. As I said, keep in mind, not only were they preemptive, they were dated back for 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a new dynamic that people are questioning whether or not it will survive legally. I suspect it will, to be quite frank, because our Supreme Court is not going to check the power of the presidency. We're moving more towards the unitary executive, meaning dictatorship. And it's interesting that the Biden administration took us closer to dictatorship with that act rather than, you know, their claim about hating dictators.
Well, Biden, for example, had his hand slapped several times by the Supreme Court when it came to forgiving student loans. They called it an illegal expropriation or appropriation, that the president doesn't write checks. He might spend the money, or his bureaucracy spends the money, but to his cabinet picks, many are standard array of sort of neocon, Republican, reactionary, like Marco Rubio. I don't know much about Bennett at Treasury, but he's, you know, he's a finance guy. As well as the more inspired, I would say, or certainly unusual picks like Kennedy, Gabbard, or even Patel, to head the FBI. Here we are debating, you know, who's going to run the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which liberals and radicals for decades have called, you know, the secret police. And now suddenly the liberal establishment is concerned with, you know, it not falling in the wrong hands and what can, because they know how powerful it is. Mm-hmm. What do you think? So just any cabinet pick you wish to comment on.
Well, let me say this also. One of the things that's interesting is I heard AOC recently talk about Donald Trump violating norms, all of these norms, right? And I thought, well, wait a minute. People are sick of the norms. They can't pay their rent because of the norms. They can't afford groceries because of the norms. The Democratic Party is now the defender of the, quote, norms. That means you're the defender of the system, the defender of the status quo. And this is a system that is not working out well for working class, working poor, and poor people. So you are clearly not on the side of those three economic class groups, number one. Number two, I think it was very illustrative watching the nomination questions and hearings for both Tulsi Gabbard and for RFK Jr. in that you could clearly see that the Democratic Party was the defender of Big Pharma. They were defender of corporations. They were the defenders of the war machine, the intelligence community. They were attacking people who were perceived as being in opposition to these groups, which traditionally the left has been attacked by. So I think it was interesting to see out in the open what the Democratic Party is now, what it stands for. I'm not saying the Republicans are great or anything, but this is a Republican administration who put in Tulsi Gabbard. I watched her hearing. It was incredible to hear her say things that were demonstrably true and listen to a senator after she got finished saying things that were clearly true about U.S. foreign policy, you know, supporting Al-Qaeda, various things of that nature. And rather than rebut anything that she said, the Democratic senator said, you're repeating Russian talking points or Iran, or maybe even Iranian talking points. This is the opposite of critical thinking. Critical thinking is, are these things true or false? Can they be substantiated? Absurdities is, that's talking points of someone else, Russia, blah, blah, as if the veracity of her statements should be judged not by whether or not we can substantiate them, but it should be judged based on somebody else said it. As if Hitler said it was raining outside in 1943, it might have been raining. Just because Hitler said it doesn't mean it wasn't raining, but these are not logical attacks. They are ideological attacks. And we saw basically We're seeing a Democratic Party that seems to be ideological rather than logical. And basically, we've got a war on epistemology. You know, how do you know what we didn't, what you know? A war on critical thinking coming from what used to call itself the left. It's really shocking, to say the least, stunning. So one of the things that has happened, I think, is that, and I'll just be blunt about this, okay? The traditional white liberals have come up with their resolutions for racism, such as DEI, right? And so they say, DEI, we got to have that. That's going to help the black people or whatever. Black people didn't come up with that. That's the white liberals came up with that, right? And now if it goes away, that's it for black people. We'll all be picking cotton on a field again somewhere. But wait a minute. DEI has only been around since 20. The office of DEI for the federal government opened in 2021, mid to late. It's been around 3.5 years. I'm supposed to believe that because this office has been around 3.5 years, that if it goes away, that it all will suddenly fall apart for black people. Number one, I used to work in this stuff. There are federal laws, EEOC laws, various constitutional interpretations and precedents that address discrimination in the workplace and things of that nature. DEI, whether it's there or not, is not founded and substantiated in these laws. It is more cultural. To me, when I look at DEI, here's my thoughts. Every time I turn on a chewing gum commercial, there's one black person, one white person, one gay person, one Asian person, etc. Every commercial, everything I see, oh, there's three superheroes. One of them's a black female, one of them's a black male, one of them's a white male. To me, that's DEI. DEI to me, this is my interpretation of it, is giving the appearance of fighting discrimination. It's making a show of it, putting all this rainbow, making a Benetton advertisement and claiming that because you're making Benetton advertisements of various people of various groups, that somehow that helps that group. DEI, in my opinion, is more symbolic than anything else. It's not that I'm opposed to it or for it, but I just don't see the results of you know, where it does anything, and where if it goes away, it's going to make a difference. The only thing it's going to hurt is that people who truly are hostile towards things like, you know, maybe Black History Month, et cetera, will use DEI to go after the things that were substantial and that were, you know, beneficial and that were good for Black culture. So to me, DEI ultimately will be one of the worst things that happen to Black people, because it will create an opportunity for those who are opposed to things that Black people really support and that perhaps some of us came up with, they'll be washed away when the DEI thing is thrown out. The baby will go out with the bathwater. That's what I'm saying.
That was part one of Pacifica broadcaster and independent podcaster Garland Nixon's conversation with Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke. Tune in to CRD for more of their conversation in upcoming shows. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Seltzer, J.R. Valerie, Thomas O'Rourke, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.